Welcome to the Profitable Steward Podcast with Jared Sorensen. In this series, we'll learn and explore regenerative agriculture principles. Through practices that improve soil health, animal health, and good stewardship, we are working to help you increase your productivity and profitability. Join us in learning from successful farm and ranch experts who share stories of growth from their fields to help your fields grow strong. Here is your host, Jared Sorensen.
This is one of the ones I just feel very honored to have Fred Provenza here with us today. Very gracious of you, Fred, to be willing to do this. Oh, been in different classes that you've taught, both I guess in person, probably years ago at the, you spoke, I think, at a Ranching for Profit conference in Canada, and then you gave a multi-day workshop at a Ranching for Profit deal somewhere, maybe Wyoming. My friend that was with me said it best. He said, if you have the opportunity to listen to Fred Provenza, it's worth driving miles and miles to go hear him speak live. So fortunately, we don't have to drive miles and miles. With the technology that we have, we can sit in our rooms in Nevada or wherever we are, and get to listen to Fred. And so go ahead, and if those that are able, if you're not multitasking here trying to drive and do something, go ahead and type in the chat where you're from, just to kind of give a feel for how wide a reach we have here today. And with that, Fred, welcome. We certainly are, again, honored to have you here with us today. Where do you currently reside, Fred? Where's home for you now?
Jared, I say first, thank you very much for having me on here. It's wonderful to be here with you. And, you know, you bring back memories, those interacting with the folks at Ranching for Profit or just top folks. I mean, that program was an incredible program. And I enjoyed all the time spent with Dave Pratt and all the folks that were Dave and Kathy and all the folks who are Ranching for Profit. So just to, you know, acknowledge how vitally important those kind of programs have been over the years. But right now, you know, I retired going on 15 years ago from Utah State. He asked if they knew I was gone. I said, I don't think they knew I ever left there. But at any rate, my wife and I moved to the backwoods of Colorado after I retired. And we're 12 miles in on graveled road from the nearest highway, and absolutely loved it. We got some kids up here in Montana, and they said, you know, you're so remote, we can hardly ever see you. And so long story short, we ended up here in Ennis, Montana. We're about roughly, you always say, 50 miles drive from where each of our kids and their spouses live nowadays, Jared.
Okay. Well, that is great. That is great. Well, wonderful. Well, we'll just let you jump right in. You're welcome. If you have a slide, you can share screen, and we'll just generally we go for 45 to 60 minutes, and then we'll do a little Q&A and wrap things up. But you know, with Fred Provenza, I would say we could be here for weeks and not run out of things to talk about, but we'll just let you run with it, Fred. And if you have questions during, please type them in the chat. We will open it up for Q&A at the end, but if there's certain things we might interject, maybe I'll be the moderator and interject those. And again, welcome everyone.
Well, Jared, you know, I didn't know that you wanted a formal presentation. I pulled up some slides that I could pull up as we went along, but I guess let me ask you this: what are you folks, Jared, you and the folks here, what would interest you most? We corresponded just a little bit about that, and I pulled up some slides that I thought that there might be an occasion here and there to pull up a slide or two to highlight that. But I'm happy too to maybe just engage in a conversation related to where people want to go. And at the appropriate times, I could pull up a slide or two, do the share screen and pull up a slide or two.
That works too.
Maybe that would tailor it to what, you know, kind of a, just a discussion. I see the various people I see that I know on here are all incredibly knowledgeable. And I'm thinking we might accomplish as much or more just with a discussion of where people want to go. I'll say one other word here. Last year, I went to Canada and gave a keynote at a conference. And the next day, they'd ask if we'd do a day-long workshop. And I said I would. And I prepared a slides for a day-long workshop. But what the guy who organized it said, you know, these people have all read your book. They've read a bunch of stuff that you've done. Let's just have a conversation. I said, well, okay, if that sounds okay, let's. And it turned out to be absolutely fabulous, better than if I'd have presented a bunch of slides, because people just were able to raise issues that were on their mind. It was really quite a day. So maybe how's that sound to you? If we do that and see where it goes. I do have some slides here that I can pull up depending where people go to make that. I think based on our little bit of correspondence where I thought, well, what might be most relevant? So does that sound okay?
It does. It does. And kind of when I was talking to somebody today, and I'm not sure if they've made it on here or not, but had a call with them. They hadn't heard of Fred Provenza. And I said, well, again, if you have the opportunity to listen to him, definitely stop what you're doing. Join us live. And if not, you know, this is being recorded. But what I had hoped, Fred, is that you could kind of help draw the connection between the animals and the land and the role that we as stewards play as having dominion over the animals and stewardship over the land and stewardship over the animals. And kind of with that, I mean, maybe give us a little bit of context and background in case there's anybody here who doesn't know what your background is, and then we'll jump into some discussion.
Okay. I'm happy to do that. You know, I'll go way back just to set a context. I grew up in what they call the heart of the Rocky Mountains, a little town called Salida. And I didn't grow up on a ranch, but when I was a senior in high school, a friend asked if I wanted to make some extra money working on a ranch, hauling hay in the evenings. I said, sure, and I absolutely loved it. So I went to work out there the next summer. I was going to college at Colorado State University in wildlife biology. The next summer, I started working out there. I worked all the years I was in college, and then I ran the place for a couple years after that. I mention that because that's been foundational, really, in everything I did from then on. You know, it was a family ranch. We had sheep and cattle primarily. We raised a few goats and some hogs for personal use and so forth. We ran cattle on summer range. And just being out there over those years, working on that ranch, the guy that I worked with was born in 1900. So when I started working on that ranch in 1969, he was already 69 years old and still going strong. And he had accumulated, he had no college education. He didn't even have grade school education. But what Henry had was a lifetime of observing and working with growing crops, with livestock. And I benefited so much from Henry's knowledge. And like I say, it really set the stage for all the research I did, really. I'll tell a story here that, you know, I was taking a class my sophomore year at Colorado State University in animal science. They're talking a lot about breeding and genetics and heterosis and the value of that. And I knew that Henry always kept his own replacement animals. Never, in the years I was there, never brought animals in from the outside to the ranch. And so when I went back, after that year, I was talking with Henry, and I mentioned that, and I said, why don't you do that? And he sat down. You know, we worked long days. I was working for $250 a month, 10-hour days, 6 days a week. So that sounds like an old person would say. But Henry would always take the time to talk. And so he sat down and he started telling me stories. He said, you know, I brought replacements in from other places. And he said, you know how when we put animals up on the summer range and they don't stay in one big bunch, they get into little groups around the landscape. And he said, we know where those little groups are going to be in each of the pastures. And we were talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres that we were grazing over. He said, when they're in certain pasture, we know when it's time to round them up and move them every few weeks where we're going to find them. And he said, you bring animals in that don't know the range. You don't know if you're going to find them. You don't know where they're going to find them. And you can be pretty certain they're not going to be bred when you bring them down from the mountains. So he said, you know, I didn't have good experience when I did that. And then he said, you know, there was a year when for several reasons, they got a little crossways with the Forest Service. And it wasn't his fault that this happened, but that's another story. But he said, we had to put our cattle and take them over to South Park, which is, I know that country really well after living there for a while, but his cattle were not familiar with that range at all. Henry wasn't either. He said it was the summer from hell. So he took time. This was probably an hour-long conversation that we had of him just telling me what he was experiencing. But he summed the whole thing up by saying, you know, the basic problem is the cows just don't know the range. And when I think of all the work that we did over, you know, probably 40 years, every bit of it was looking at what does it mean for an animal to know the range. And we really, you know, up till that time, I think folks had primarily focused on genetics, and certainly genetics is very, very important, no question about that. But there's this whole other part about what animals learn, that they start to actually to learn when they're in the womb. Learning what's food and what's not from the foods that mother eats. You know, the flavors of foods that she eats gets into her amniotic fluid, and the fetal taste system's fully functional during the last trimester of gestation. So, you know, and then when they're born, flavors get into mother's milk, and then mother is a model. And so we were doing lots of studies with goats and sheep and cattle, just retracing that and showing from a scientific standpoint that that really matters, that that makes a big difference, not only in food selection, but also in habitat selection as well, you know, where animals go in the country. And so I think what we were doing that hadn't been done before was just simply pointing out what does it mean for an animal to know the range, and then helping people to understand how important learning, they don't just know these things, they need to learn what and what not to eat, what's a predator, what's not a predator, where you go to do the best during different seasons and so forth, how to self-medicate. We showed over and over again that animals can learn how to. So I think that's what we were really contributing to the knowledge base, not only from the standpoint of domestic animals, but for wild species as well. It got a lot of people thinking about what they'd assumed. It's just in the genes. They just know what to do, to really coming to appreciate the importance of social learning and culture. And all that came from, you know, Henry set the stage for that. And it wouldn't, you know, he died before we were, you know, long time ago, but it wouldn't have surprised him. He would have appreciated all the things that we were learning because he'd experienced that. And so what I think about nowadays too is there's different ways of knowing, And certainly I was raised in the science tradition of, you know, you use science to try to figure things out and to learn. And that's certainly one way. But there's another way that I think doesn't get the consideration that it should. And that's this experience, just the personal experience of the environment. And then as that can get passed on from generation to generation over time, I think is very important. So that's, you know, we were really involved there in trying to look at the role of learning. And then this whole field that's just blossomed nowadays of epigenetics dovetailed so nicely with what we were doing, because that shows that these genes get expressed as a function of experience. And so that helps animals to really be fine-tuned to the environment that they're in. I remember there was a NOVA special called Ghost in Your Genes that came out many years ago now. And the group that was working with together at Utah State, people like Sheldon and many, many others, we went to watch that NOVA special. And I was talking to a young fella who had just gotten his PhD in epigenetics and studies like that. And we were talking, and I said, you know, he was talking about the work that we'd done. He was familiar with it. And I said, well, you know, we really didn't study epigenetics. And he said, yes, you did. And I was so happy when he said that, because he appreciated, even though we weren't looking at which genes were being turned on and turned off, we were looking at the outcome of that, not only on the behavior of animals, but we would take animals, for instance, I'll give you a couple of examples here. The first studies we did with goats were goats that had been born and raised down in southern Utah on this country that's dominated by a shrub called blackbrush. It's a nasty country. It's really, it's tough country. Shrub dominated. And by the way, those cattle ranchers down there run cattle. They winter their cattle on that country. And that was another education for me, seeing how cattle could put their head down and mow brush and how well they could perform on that. And that was as a result of these experiences they had early in life. Well, we were doing that with goats and comparing how their organ systems developed as a function of being born and raised on blackbrush with goats that were born and raised on high quality foods, you know, fed alfalfa hay during the winter and stuff. And it was amazing. For instance, when we would do autopsies on those animals and look at rumen development, the rumens of animals that had been raised on those poor quality forages were huge compared to the rumens of animals that were raised on high quality forages. And kidney function, rumen development, liver function, all those things get influenced through epigenetics as a function of these experiences early in life. We got into some studies that Sheldon got involved with quite a lot. And then I'm going to be quiet for a minute here. But during the BEHAVE program, we've been working for 25 years on studies trying to understand all this that I'm talking about and much, much more. But about 24 years ago now, I was diagnosed with cancer. And obviously I made it, but after I had surgery for cancer in December, when I went back to the university after that, a couple of people that I was really close to over the years and I were sitting down and saying, you know, if you don't make it, if you just honest talk, you don't make it, all this work we've been doing that we've been talking about that really has implications for ranchers, because we'd all been on ranches. So none of that's going to get out. So we said we should try to get a program. That's where Kathy both came into this old deal, and Beth. We should try to get a program where we can share this information with people from around the country. And this program called BEHAVE, we were able to get a large grant and pull people together for that program. And That program lasted 10 years, and we were working with some of the most innovative people we could find from around the country. Our first advisory board meeting, and Sheldon, you'll remember that, we had 45 people there that we'd invited, and we went over all the things we'd been learning about. And then we invited them to be a part of the program, and we worked so closely. We were all students working together, trying to address issues that the key issues that the ranchers faced, whatever the issue was. And it was everything from how do you retrain a herd of 1,000 elk to not utilize winter feed grounds, to how do you use domestic animals to improve sagebrush dominated landscapes, and on and on and on. But that was a culmination of that work, and it was amazing to be able to work hand in hand with progressive ranchers and to tackle issues together. And I think all the time they weren't so interested in increasing productivity as they were in increasing profitability. And we were primarily doing that by looking at how do we cut costs? How do we cut costs in ranch operation, which really led us toward how do we get out of fossil fuel loops? How do we cut those bills? And I'm happy to talk about various projects we did at that time and anything where people want to go. But that's a long-winded background introduction and kind of overview of some of what we were doing, Jared, over the years. And have to say, working with people like Sheldon and many other folks. You know, the first year that we had our advisory board meeting for BEHAVE, 45 people were invited. By the end of that program, 250 people were attending that advisory board meeting. It was really a moving experience. And I think when I think about the land grant university systems, the land grant systems, and Abe Lincoln got that started, I really have to think that was what he had in mind when he created the land grant systems, was researchers working hand in hand with people on the ground to try to help them be profitable and to try to tackle challenging issues. And that's certainly what we did during that 10 years of the BEHAVE program.
Yeah, thank you for that overview. That's wonderful. I actually attended, I think it was at Midway, one of the BEHAVE conferences that you had there. And pretty neat to see what some innovative people were doing about utilizing sagebrush as forage and just some of these things that we think are impossible. You're definitely always push the limits and challenge people's paradigms. So with what you've seen, I mean, probably worldwide, but certainly throughout the United States, what are some of the similarities that you find in ranchers who are highly successful, Fred?
The ones that we worked with, their minds were really open, I would say. You know, they didn't lock in, and certainly there's value in knowing the way grandparents did it, right? Or the older generations, the way that they did things, and they appreciated that. But they were also thinking, what's going on ecologically, economically, socially nowadays, what's happening, and how can we best manage in ways that address those challenges? And I learned so much, working with those folks. We were all learning. And I think that idea that we were all students, that set a good context, because we weren't there as know-it-alls, like the university people, maybe as know-it-alls or something. We were in that mode that we're all, look, we've got these challenges. Are there ways that we can address those challenges? And I think those people were just really open. And those meetings, we'd have breakout groups where we'd have the groups talking about challenging questions and then coming back and reporting on what their discussions were, and all that was just, it was just fueling this excitement. It was really, but I think those people that we were working with were just really, you know, their minds weren't locked in. They were, I think they were lifelong learners, I would say, and just doing amazing kinds of things. I could mention so many of them that are coming to mind. It's been a while since I talked about this stuff and thought about it, but so many of them are coming to mind, and I think they were an inspiration for everyone as to try to be, keep your mind open and be thinking about what's happening, and then be willing to change, to continually adapt. That didn't mean throwing out all that you'd learned in the past, but thinking about how to continually adapt as the world around you was changing. It was a great model, I think, for how to live a life, actually, more generally, you know, of how you move along with things as they move, as everything moves and changes.
Yeah. So, you know, you talk about how things change and evolve. There certainly are some constants, but what do you see like in agriculture right now from your perspective? Maybe a little bit removed from it now, but you might have a better perspective because of that. What do you see are some of the greatest challenges that we are currently facing, Fred?
Oh, that's a big question. And I think let's get other people to, including you, Jared, to weigh in on that. I don't know if this is the biggest. I think agriculture right now is situated in a position where we can truly be, I'm not hands-on involved anymore, but where agriculture can just be such a shining light. I think the people in this country have really lost touch with where food comes from. That's a quote from Henry DeLuca from, you know, 60 years ago, but, you know, don't know where food's come from. And I think you look at the poor health of people in this country nowadays. You just walk around and look, and I'm not trying to be condemning or anything, but just the obesity, the diabetes, the all the symptoms. There's a doctor I work with up here who worked on the program actually way back in the day and saw the light, decided better get into something else, but I really appreciate him a lot. He works with diet entirely. He doesn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but he said, look, most of the issues that we've got are diet related. The crummy diet, the ultra processed food, 60% of calories that people ingest come from ultra processed foods. So it's no wonder. And there's a lot of studies to show how poor that is on our health. So he said, first, we're going to get your diet right. Then if you've got any issues, we'll deal with them. But odds are you won't have any issues once you get your diet sorted out. So what I'm trying to say, I think, is ag can play such a fundamental role in health. What is health? Next week, I'm going up north here to Malta to visit with a guy named Bob Quinn. He's been farming organically and growing ancient grains and stuff forever. And we had a conversation the other day. I told him I had been asked to give a talk to a class of medical students, which I'd given a talk and talking about agriculture and the value of wholesome foods. And he said, you know, we need to be growing wholesome foods for people, plant and animal foods, and we should be getting paid like pharmacists are being paid because we're really the pharmacy. And I couldn't agree more with that. You know, without going into the details of it all, but on what wholesome foods that are raised under with good soils. I think this emphasis nowadays, and I know it's maybe 5% of the ranchers, 10% at most are doing, but you know, there's various labels for it. But just trying to think about the value of diverse plant diversity and healthy soils, and how that's good for the health of livestock. I'm tickled to see studies coming out now that just show when animals are able to eat a diverse array of different plant species, how important that is for their health, how that boosts their immune system, how all these phytochemicals that we studied over the years that come under broad classes of terpenes and phenolics and alkaloids and stuff can promote health in small doses when animals are exposed to those. And then showing that the food that we eat, and for instance, if cows or sheep have been eating diverse arrays of foods and having all these phytochemicals in their diets, it gets into their meat and milk, and then we ingest that. So it's good for our health. And there's some nice studies that are starting to come out that it's young people that are really running and gunning in that sense. But I just think agriculture, you know, and I know issues, for instance, issues like changing climate, to what degree do humans involved? And there's a lot of controversy about that, right? Depending on what the audience is. But what I think always is that, look, if you're raising animals in ways that that are integrating them into practices and trying to enhance the biodiversity of the landscapes through plant diversity, I like to say plants turn dirt into soil, and diverse mixtures of plants turn soil into homes, grocery stores, and pharmacies for all life above and beyond ground. So if we're being stewards in that sense, I think we're really improving the health of the planet. And you know, as you fix carbon in the soil, the amount, the water holding capacity of those soils goes up tremendously, the amount of carbon that can be fixed in the soils. And I love to talk about long-term research that shows when you've got diverse mixtures of plants, the nutrient content of the plants goes up, of all of the plants, compared to monoculture. So this idea of diversity and plant diversity and trying to think about how to enhance that, I think is very important. So I just see agriculture as so foundational to the health of the planet and everybody on it. So that's what I think about a lot. And then I think about some of the issues like fake meat. I'm going to target some of, you know, I don't like to be negative on anybody or anything, but some of these things, you know, like fake meat, it's one more ultra-processed food. Do we need one more ultra-processed food on this planet? And there's no way that a human, no matter how technologically savvy they are, is going to create a fake meat that's anywhere near a piece of meat or milk or cheese that comes from an animal that's eating a phytochemically diverse diet that has tens of thousands of these so-called phytochemicals in their diet that's getting into the meat, getting into the milk. You know, it's the way the Creator made this amazing systems that we live in, and being stewards of that and thinking about how can we be steward, how are those systems, how have they evolved and developed, and how can we try to work with that in partnership with those systems? I just think agriculture is, and I don't think I'm saying this because of my background, I just really believe agriculture is foundational to all that. And how can we get people to the general public to appreciate that in a general way, and then the nuance of that. And I have to say, I'm encouraged by a bunch that I've seen during my lifetime, and the young people I see nowadays who are interested in being involved in ag and in research, that trying to establish the value of agriculture and working with plant and animal communities in ways that enhances life below and above ground. I think that's really important. I think as we've gone from the early part of the last century, when most people, I think, really were involved to one degree or another with agriculture, to where we are now, where it's just such a small percent of the population, we lost a lot. I think when I grew up in Salida, and I think of my grandparents' generation in particular, they all raised incredible gardens. Huge, beautiful gardens. They knew how to grow such delicious food. They all had chickens. Some of them had a hog. They were still in touch with where food comes from. They really were. And then you come to my parents' generation, much, much less of that. And then you come to my generation and beyond. And I think there's just not much of that. One of the things I like to do in the talks that I give nowadays, so Sue and I live on an acre and a half here in Innes. It's a rock pile. It's an absolute rock pile. It's the worst, harshest place we've ever lived and tried to grow anything. But we're figuring out how to do that. And what we've done, I don't like to say this because it sounds like bragging. It's not. But what we did, we've put in deep beds all around so we can grow vegetables. And we figured out how to do that. We've got some chickens here. But there was a little lawn planted around here. We've let that become infested with clover, so we don't have to fertilize it. We never fertilize a thing. But what we've done is let the native plants take over most all of this acre and a half. And it's amazing the diversity of different grass and forb species that are native here. Why do we do that? Well, that gets us out of fossil fuel loops, right? We don't have to irrigate it. We don't have to fertilize it. We don't have to cut it. And it's amazing to us to see the number of people who will be driving down the road and they'll stop and they'll say, "Your place is so beautiful. What did you do here?" And we just say, "We didn't do anything. We just have the native plants." And we do, you know, the beds have sunflowers in them, and we've planted hundreds of species of native shrubs and trees around the place. But the reason I say that is, it seems to me that's a way to get back in touch with where food comes from, what life is, the bees, the insect populations, all the life. You know, most people can't be ranchers or farmers. They don't own the ground. But if you own even a little piece of ground, you can be a farmer or a rancher in a sense and get back in touch with where food and nourishment and life comes from. So that's kind of rambling on, but those are things I think about nowadays and think a lot about how can, and I see people, and I'm sure people that are on this call are doing this too, you know, of reaching out to people in their communities. Francois, we buy meat from Francois, who's here north of Missoula in Trout Creek, raising animals in all the ways that we're talking about, doing those things, reaching out to people in the community. And I think, to me, agriculture can really be a guiding light, maybe, to get people back in touch with where food comes from, but more generally with where life below and above ground comes from, and in that sense be a steward of the landscapes that we inhabit. So that's what I think about a lot nowadays. And you know, it makes me so happy too. This came out of the blue, but a fellow in Clemson, and then a lady that wanted me to give this talk for this class of medical students. I think, you know, that's great if you can start to talk to the general public about these kinds of things. And we can all do that, huh? Try to get people thinking about the value of agriculture, and that agriculture is the solution. It's not the problem. That's okay. I'll go one other thing. So cows nowadays are in the crosshairs when it comes to methane, right? I mean, methane is a gas with incredible heat potential 25 to what, 30 times higher, 28 times higher than CO2 and so forth. So constantly hearing about methane, and cattle are producing methane. But you know what? I've been working on a paper with a friend in New York who was a professor during his career, but he was also a farmer, rancher, and has done some amazing work related to what we're talking about. But the point that we're making in this paper, and we do a bunch of statistical analyses, is that when you look at methane production and you look at what's happened over the last 30 years, roughly, cattle numbers have declined globally. They've gone down. Yet methane has gone up steadily up. When you do the analyses on that, where that methane is cut. So agriculture's number one in methane production. Wetlands are number two. But very closely behind all that is fossil fuels. It's fracking and natural gas production, oil and natural gas. And when you look at the relationship between deliberate release of gas from those wells and inadvertent release, that is so highly correlated with what's happening with methane production. I don't know if I'm making sense or not, but the point is cows are not the culprit. When you look at the big picture, cattle numbers have gone down, so their production of methane is going down. At the same time, methane production is going up. And so the point of that paper that we've just submitted to a scientific journal is that cows aren't the culprit, you know, so take them out of the crosshair. Sure, they can. The other point, too, is that the methane that's coming from oil and gas production is coming from sources that have been buried underground for millions of years, basically, by now. The methane that's coming from cattle is coming as a result of their ingesting plants. They eat plants, and it's part of the carbon dioxide cycle. They aren't adding new methane or carbon dioxide to the system. They are simply circulating what's already in the system. That methane, over a decade, gets converted to CO2. That CO2 is taken in by plants as a part of photosynthesis. The cows eat the plants, and as a part of digestion, they do release some methane. The amount they release, though, can be greatly modified depending upon their diet. If they have tannin-containing plants in their diet, it reduces methane production. So again, I'm kind of going on and on, but. You know, it's that idea that, look, agriculture is fundamentally important to life, and agriculture is not the problem. It's a solution to a lot of the issues that people are concerned about nowadays, I would say. So that's old people, huh? Infinite digress.
We appreciate your ramblings, Fred. They're wonderful. We all benefit from it.
I'm happy too, Jared, you know, to back up everything I'm saying with scientific papers that have been published on all of these things, and including the one on methane, to share an abstract at least with. I'm happy to share. I try to make sure that the points I'm making have some basis, that it's not just me rambling on without basis. So I just say that I'm happy to share. I've got so much scientific papers that I could share from a variety of sources if people are interested in that.
That'd be great. So at the end, we'll get contact information, best way to get a hold of you. And maybe we can jump into some questions that have come through the chat here, and then we'll open it up. If people want to unmute and ask questions, we'd certainly welcome that. But one of the questions, Fred, is about changing predator behavior. We know that there needs to be balance, right? If we remove the predators, sometimes there's unintended consequences with that. But at the same time, when we suffer economic losses from wolves, bears, cougars, whatever it might be, sometimes we have to take some intervention there. So can you speak to that, just changing predator behavior?
Yes, a couple of thoughts come to mind, Jared, when you say that. There are situations where there are issues with predators that have to be dealt with. I have a friend in France, Michel Mireille, that I've knew as a colleague way back when, probably 40 years ago, and we've remained very good friends. He during a lot of his career was studying shepherding practices in France, what shepherds do to enhance the use of rangelands over there, which is amazing what they do, the various courses to a meal and so forth. But in the last 10 years, he's gotten involved with predator issues. They weren't a big deal back in the day, but they've really become a big deal. Wolves are a huge, huge issue. And they have some of the same kind of controversies that we have nowadays here between, environmental groups that certainly make the case predators are a part of these systems and they need to be a part of the systems. But then also the livestock producer standpoint, that the huge losses that can occur with that. And over in France, they were trying different techniques from night pens with electrified fences to fladry to one thing or another. But where Michelle has gone with this, and I think rightfully so, is there are some situations where none of that's going to work. And so what he's tried carefully and over time to do is to say that, hunting and shooting needs to be a part of that as of predator management. And I would say the same thing would be here in the U.S. There's some individuals and so forth where that's what needs to be done. So I'm certainly recognize that. Here where we live in Montana, the Madison Range is a wilderness area. It's beautiful range to the east of us here. And grizzlies, there are a lot of grizzlies. And every year in the spring of the year, there's grizzlies attacking people. In the fall of the year, there's grizzlies attacking people. It's a presence. It influences what you think when you're thinking about going for a hike or whatever you're doing, because you could end up being attacked by a grizzly. And one of the things my wife said forever is that, they need to have some hunting going on of those grizzlies so that grizzlies don't see us simply as a meal, but this could be a threat. And that their offspring learn too, that this can be a threat. They're learning behaviors too. So that's one side. There's another side too that I think is very interesting about what you said. We were working a lot with people at Deseret Land and Livestock in northern Utah over the years. And wonderful, wonderful folks. As you know, that's one of the ranches that the Mormon Church owns, 360,000 acres. And I remember there was a lot of predator work going on there at the time that was really insightful. And I'd never really thought much about it until that work was done. But they said, look, if you're running livestock and you're not having any issue with predators, don't go shoot predators randomly because you can upset the balance of what's happening. They were working with coyotes and sheep at that point in time. And they said, because if you take out an alpha pair, then that opens up for another pair to come in, and they may not have the same dietary habits. They may start predating. So that I think that was a really good point too. If you're not having issues, there was a lot of time where we just shot predators indiscriminately, right? To go out and that was what you do. And so that was a cautionary tale with that. If you're not having problems, don't cause problems yourself by shooting animals that may be really your friends in a sense, if that makes sense. So those are some thoughts related to the issue of predators. I know I've met some people here in Montana, over in the Paradise Valley, that run cattle, and folks over in Idaho that run cattle, and they got really into this idea of shepherding and riding and spending time with livestock, and they were able to really, by doing that, I think from what they told me, to really decrease incidents of predation by their presence and their being out there and working with cattle. That's not for everyone. I mean, there's a lot you can do if it works for you. For these folks, it worked. They thought it was really a profitable move that they made in that sense. But
yeah,
human presence was really helping in that sense. They felt.
Great answer. Yeah.
With wolves and grizzly bears. Grizzly bears in the one case, wolves in the other case.
Okay.
Yeah.
The next question here, Fred, is on diversity. And if Tom, if you're able to unmute, maybe you can give some context for this. But just some people say legumes are not desirable in a species mix because they could be toxic, he says. Can you add some more context to that, Tom?
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Fred.
Good to see you.
Yeah. I'm glad you're in good health.
Yes. And you too. It's been a while. I think of you from time to time. No, I'll tell you honestly, wonder how you're doing.
Well, I always enjoy these opportunities. You know, some of us just don't have that many people to talk to about this stuff. So it's fantastic to get together like this. So much appreciated. So here's one of the recent mysteries for me, and it's kind of in the category of having to unteach yourself, you know, after 40 years of knowing a truth, and then you finally realize maybe it's not a truth. We've had a couple of speakers on the national circuit come through, not Jim Gerrish, other people come through and give pasture walks in Vermont in the last year or so. And one of them in particular, I admire in terms of his scientific background. He's a veterinarian and pasture manager, has been for many, many years. And he was giving a talk at the Vermont Organic Dairy Conference last March, and he showed a slide of a beautiful patch of Wisconsin pasture that I think everyone in the room would agree was biodiverse. It had plantains and dandelion, four or five grasses, various other forbs. And he said, what stands out in this picture? And of course, I had to raise my hand and I said, no legumes. And he said, correct. And he said, we've learned over the years, at least in these Wisconsin pastures that have high organic matter, that there's enough nitrogen cycling from from biological nitrogen fixation, but not from legumes, to support these productive biodiverse pastures. So he got me thinking. And I've been in touch with him once or twice since about this. But then another speaker came through last spring from Mississippi and pronounced that we really don't want legumes in our pastures because they're actually more toxic than most of us realize. And they're probably less beneficial than beneficial to our ruminants. And so I'm not sure that he had quite the same scientific background as the first speaker, but I was just curious about your perspective on this now, because, you know, back to the 40 years of truth, we've always been promoting 20 to 40% legumes, particularly if they're non-bloating, but even if they're bloating legumes, 20, 40%, maybe even 50% if we're good managers in our pasture mixtures, dry matter basis. But maybe we're out of touch. Maybe that's not good advice to be giving our producers. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's good, Tom. I hadn't heard that. I can think, though, that some legumes, you know, can have compounds in them that could potentially be toxic, right?
Sure.
That could be toxic. So one could say, yeah, that certainly could be the case. And then, you know, if you've got if nitrogen isn't an issue, as the one speaker was saying from Wisconsin, I think I know who that probably was, actually, from what you're saying. I like him a lot.
Greg Brickner.
Yeah. You know, it's always good to, and I appreciate what you said, to have a think about those things, though, right? You know, and think, well, you know, but probably not throw the baby out with the bathwater, I'd say, either, because depending on the location and what's going on, why, they might be a really huge, important addition to the mix. And then in other cases, why, they might not be as important. Or, you know, we know that so many of these plants, depending upon the site where they're growing, the resources available to them, water, nutrients, sunlight, their chemistries can change so much. Strikes me a lot. I'm thinking right now of a mix, for instance, of that a person might not want, in the sense that you're talking, of endophyte infected tall fescue with alfalfa. Alfalfa fixing nitrogen leads to higher levels of alkaloids in the fescue. So we know it gets complex under the opposite too. If you have alfalfa growing with tannin containing plants, well, it can reduce the concentration of tannins because you get more growth. So I think that's really, I appreciate your question. It's good, your reflections. I mean, telling the fuller story of that. And I think it's always good for us to have those kind of things come along too, huh? Where it gets us thinking about generalizations that we've made, but not throw the baby out with the bathwater with that. I certainly wouldn't do that. I think that, you know, all the work you did over the years and some of the folks at Utah State that were really looking at some of the tannin-containing legumes like birdsfoot trefoil and sandfoin, and, you know, I can sure see value under some of the situations that you guys were working. So I think... I can see all those along a continuum of all of that, but I think that's a little too harsh to say, you know, we don't need legumes at all. There's certainly roles they can play. I'm thinking of a paper too from the Tallgrass Prairie that I'll share with you guys from Minnesota, if you want. And you've probably seen it. Tillman was one of the authors on it. It was like a 16-year study. Do you know that? Yeah, where they were.
Well, I'm not sure about the specific paper, but I know generalities of the work.
Yeah, long-term studies, and they were comparing mixtures of like 16 different species with some legumes in there versus monocultures. And it was amazing what they were showing in terms of nutrient contents of all those plants had gone up. The carbon in the soil had gone up, and they were just making the case that diversity over a long time does amazing things for systems. And then we know what that does for the microbiome below ground and above ground. So that was a case where they had legumes as part of it, and they were talking functional diversity, the functional relationships among the plants. And in Wisconsin, they probably had it on that. And so do we need to add a legume? Probably not. But then, you know, in other places, I can sure see the value of them.
Yeah. Good. Okay.
Yeah. Thank good to you. See you, great. Tom. I miss these kind great of conversations question. Too. Yeah. I don't get to be as involved as back in the day of the constant just conversations like this though, that we're always challenging you to think about. Jared, you mentioned some of the sagebrush work we did. When we started into that, some people said, well, sagebrush is toxic. There's no way you're going to be able to use that, you know? But we figured out, and that's all of us, figured, you know, so all that, it's good to have your paradigms challenged all the time, hon, to think. But I think to not throw the baby, I've said this too many times, but to not throw the baby out with the bathwater either. Look at it as long these continuums, huh? Try to integrate it all into our thought processes. I'm trying to do that still all the time, but the older you get, it can be sometimes it's depending which particular paradigm's being challenged, it can be a challenge too.
So maybe a key takeaway is context matters.
I think,
that's how you answer some of these things.
I honestly think that's so much. I think there are principles and processes, and that's what we were trying to understand in the studies we were doing. How does this work? But then you have to, so that would be like the elementary idea that underlies it. But then everything becomes culturally inflected in time and space, right? And that's the context. And that's where the context changes. I really tried, Jared, you know, when we're doing all those workshops over the years and stuff, to not say this is the way that you should do anything. I really, I used to use different people as examples, but that was really deliberate. To not say, well, you know, such and such does it this way, and I think that's the way everybody ought to do it, or we've found this, and I think this is, but to say, you know, how does it work? What are the principles and processes? And then in your place, in your particular place, how do you use that knowledge? And everybody's different, right? Everyone's unique, and I think the way that we manage land, can reflect that in beautiful ways. So no two alike on this planet.
That's what I appreciate about you, Fred, is that it's not a prescription, and that is with as much experience as you have, you don't pretend to be the expert. You recognize that you're still a student in the process, and do you feel like coming from that paradigm place of humility has allowed you to progress faster and learn more versus thinking that you know it all or pretending that you do?
I hope so, Jared. I'm happy to hear you say that, you know, because it's easy to, you know, to get the ego involved in all this stuff. And that's the worst thing, I think. You know, I'm going to digress again on you here just to tell something, though. You know, when I started Utah State, I was just I loved research. That was the whole world to me once I got there. But as I went along, I got more and more interested in teaching. And during the last 10 years or so I was there at Utah State, I really evolved a lot the way that I taught. And it was a humbling experience, actually. You know, in late 80s, early 90s, I had depression for about 5 years, really just so depressed, couldn't. But it transformed me. That depression, depression transformed me. It's a one hanging by a thread. You wonder how you make some of that. My wife was a saint during those years to help me. But it transformed the way I looked at things. And I started to teach in a different way. I quit being the talking head that I lecture, you take notes, and then you tell me what I told you on a test. To me, that became so anti what I think teaching should be about. I started to think more and more that I wanted the students to be involved. So this was an evolution as it went along in these classes, trying to figure And I realized that where I really wanted to go was to have dialogue where everyone was participating and not just shoot the shit kind of, you know, well, let's come in here and just, it was rigorous. It was very rigorous. Those classes, you know, there were reading materials, there were things that had to be. And then in class, I would say, okay, so now we're going to address, and they were issues of the day, issues that we're dealing with nowadays in big ways. We'd come into class and the students would lead. So I'd say, okay, Jared, now, you know, we're going to be discussing such and such. Now you get the class started on that, you know. But what, and so you would have to be prepared. They'd come in so prepared. It was amazing, you know. It was, because they never knew when I was going to call on them and they would get some points for that. But what happened too, and I realized this, that you have to not be afraid to be vulnerable in front of a group, to speak from your heart. And that's where letting the ego go, where, you know, okay, I don't know everything. I know I don't know everything. And so from the first day of class, I would try to set that stage through, we'd all introduce ourselves. And when I introduced myself, I'd try to set that stage and realize too, that in those days, and probably still that way now, this upper level undergrad class I was teaching had students from all across campus, from really strong environmental events to animal science to range. And they came in there ready to fight, man. They were ready. Cattle free by 93, all the issues that were going on, that are still going on, they were ready to fight one another. But what was amazing to me was when that came together and those students sat and we would all listen to one another with respect, how much knowledge. I was stunned at it, you know, because you think of the students, well, they don't know anything, blah, blah, blah. They do know. They have a lot of that they bring to a class like that. And to sit there and listen to them interact with one another in meaningful, very meaningful and heartfelt ways and not attack one another once we got everything going. You know, I mean, that's what they thought. This is war and by God, we're ready to fight. But to have them... to have them listen and communicate, it was the most moving thing ever. And I thought, there's no way that I could ever go back to I lecture, you take notes. This is kind of, this sounds judgmental, but it's a kind of an arrogant thing. Once you realize the knowledge, and that's where, you know, this group here, think all the knowledge that's in this group. That it's tremendous that people can share. And that's what happened at that day-long workshop in Canada. It was just a sharing like that. It took me back to those days of those, and so much knowledges and information is shared in that way. It's just, it's a moving, moving experience. So that was, you know, that depression, was really a humbling thing. And then the teaching experience and learning that, all those, and then the behave, all that was happening, all that was helping me to try to be more humble about things, huh? Then the way to keep the mind open is to say, I definitely don't know anything. And if somebody like Tom with that example there, you know, to try to take it on board and to try to think in terms of principle, that's what I always did, think in terms of principle and process and what would allow that to happen and how can that happen and what all can happen to make the system, you know, a lot of nitrogen in the system without legumes and to make plants toxic and so forth. Just trying to understand how nature works was amazing to me. And then trying to work with other people to all work together with that and behave. So all those were kept me, you know, just kept me in that, more in that mode of trying to be humble and trying to let the ego go, and then just realizing how much you can learn when you do that, when you're just listening and interacting and doing that from the heart rather than when you get in these deals where everybody's trying to one-up everybody else. And, you know, the challenges we face, that's why you say the undergrad class, the challenges we face aren't I lecture, you take notes, you put it back to me on a test. You know, they're big challenges. And we've all got to be working together, whether you're a strong, hardcore environmentalist or a strong animal scientist or range scientist. I used to tell them, I don't care what you think, I just want you to think. And so the exams were that way too. You know, let's go over what we've covered here and that, and then tell me what it means to you personally and professionally. And if you think it's just hogwash, say that too. And it was amazing to read the replies, to read those exams, and to watch how students evolved during the semester. It was just, it was amazing to watch that and to just think, you know, if we could do that as people in society too, where we listen to one another and try to think about, we've got big challenges, we may not agree on them all, but how do we sit down and listen with respect and dignity to one another and think about how to address these big challenges? We've got a ton nowadays, huh? Ecologically, economically, socially, politically, my goodness. But, you know, how do you, it's too bad, I think, that we don't do, when you'd read some of what the students would say at the end of that class too, in the discussion, it's just, it made you realize the power of people with different world views to come together and to deal with challenges, how powerful that was. That's what struck me. It was, yeah, so there's another long digression. But
That's wonderful. We've got a couple of your students here in the class today, and I wonder if I could put them on the spot. James, maybe if you can kind of speak to what you've learned. So James Stewart, you know, I've had long conversations about being a student of Fred's, and then Sheldon, if you're in a place where you can unmute and would like to share also, I think it'd just be not only a tribute to Fred, but just a way that these two men have taken what they've learned in that environment and they've run with it and they've been extremely successful and influential. And so James, would you feel comfortable to share in just a bit? Figure out technology here. I might be able to manually unmute him.
There we go. How about now?
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Jared. As a young student, I was 23 when I started college with a family. Came off the ranch, and my first couple semesters at Utah State, I was a fish out of water, failing traditional education, and I wasn't sure if I was in the right place until I took class from Fred, this class that he talked about. It was through him that I learned how I learned. He challenged the way that I had been brought up and some of the paradigms that I had set by making us read mythology and Buddhism and all sorts of challenges that some of that stuff, but reading, I was like, I don't even get this. I don't know what's going on, but it challenged how I thought and how I saw life and saw the world and saw how other people think. And it literally, Fred, your class changed my life and has led me down a whole life of opportunities that I'm forever grateful. Just to wrap it up, we talked this whole semester about cycles and ecology and interactions and all these life lessons that you had, and that research was great, but I'll never forget your closing remarks of that class when you said we need less passion in what we do and more compassion, and it's about the relationships that we have in life. And Fred, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your mentoring and the view of life that you've given me. And I guess what,
it, I feel the same way. You're going to make me cry, I have to say. But, you know, it was people like you, all you and all those folks just made life worth living for me. You know, those relationships that we developed, it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. And James and I have stayed in touch, and we talk every so often. It's been fantastic. And fantastic to see all the things that you've been doing as you've gone along, James. It warms my heart, brings tears to my eyes. I'll have to tell you that too.
Yeah, what you preached, you lived, and I think that's one of the greatest things that I took out of it is just seeing your example. I mean, you taught and lived by example.
Well, I know too, and I won't take too much time here, but some of the things that I had you guys read back in the day, I lost some classes back in those days until, but I mentioned the depression that I had for 5 years, and I woke up to a whole bunch of things that I hadn't been exposed to. I won't go into the details, but all that got reflected in some of those classes too, just things that I hadn't thought about, that I hadn't been raised with, hadn't been taught, that came across that. And I thought, boy, how can I bring this into a class? And after that depression, I thought, I can never, the class have to be about bigger things, like we talk, you know, the bigger. And so, but there were a class or two, James, I lost them. I can guarantee you that. And that was a lonely feeling. And you can laugh because you can understand why I'm some of that too. This is a range principles class. What the hell are we reading this for? You know? But it finally
managing ecological managing dynamic ecological systems was the title of that class 20 years later.
Yeah. Yes.
And we're reading about Buddhism and mythology.
No, it was a wonderful thing, and we were all participating. That was what became so meaningful, you know, and to realize, and I was thinking of you actually, I didn't know, realize you were on. You and I was thinking about just the knowledge that students that was in those classrooms. It was a humbling thing to, and when people spoke from their hearts, and I think that's what happened in those classes. And we covered the waterfront, didn't we? I mean, from spirituality to practicality to you name it. And people weren't afraid to just speak from their heart. And it was so powerful. It was so powerful. I miss that, actually. I miss that more than the research. I've been gone a long time, of course, but that was just so deeply meaningful to see how we would all evolve as we went along in those classes, all of us, me included, you know, and same with the BEHAVE program, how much we all evolved, and just let you realize the power of community. And if we, people from different backgrounds, can work together, what you can accomplish, huh? As opposed to polarizing and so forth. So,
so much of that was just letting go what you knew and try to understand the system and where people were coming from, where the systems were coming from. People are, it didn't matter what aspect, financial, ecological, or social, there's a lot to learn by observing and gathering.
And it became fun, didn't it? I mean, it was fun to do that. I remember one gal who sat up front one year. She said, do you realize how mind-twisting it is to come into this class from other classes? And I learned later on from one of my colleagues that some of the colleagues thought that it shouldn't be teaching that way, you know, because you're the prof and you should be lecturing to the students. But I was well along in my career at that point, and I just knew this was the right thing. I just knew that this, and what you experienced, that you just realized realized the power of that and how interesting and enjoyable it could be too, to hear all those different views of people. As you say, letting go what you think you know, and winds back to Tom's comment about something as simple in one sense as legumes or no legumes, but just kind of trying to keep the mind open all the time.
Thank you, James. Sheldon, do you have some thoughts here? And then we'll probably wrap this up.
Yeah, for sure. I can throw in a little bit, but I guess to tie it back to the theme of your whole program, Jared, is that for me, the whole concept of regenerative agriculture kind of overlaps with aspects of what Fred's talking about that transcend agriculture. It's about regenerative living, regenerative learning, and regenerative understanding that comes in the form of that compassion that he talked about for others, that comes in the form of comprehending the complexity of all of these systems, right? But the complexity of these systems, living systems, the agriculture systems, economic systems, whatever, really all boils down. And for me, this is the real gem that Fred just conveyed to me more than anything else, that the real gem is the simplicity of the principles that govern it all. There's a handful of these nested principles that just get repeated throughout every ecological, biological, economic system there is, where, yeah, everything is context dependent. And the inflections are always unique depending on the combination of current circumstances and past history and present need, right? That concept of satiety is one of those principles of how bad you need a glass of water depends a lot on how long since you had a glass of water, right? And how important, you know, your mother's influence was on you has a lot to do with the environment that you're going to be in later in life. And all of these things, these same principles keep cropping up in all aspects of life. And for me, that was just so fun and so profound to see that concept. And not just as individual humans and individual animals and individual plants and patches of soil, that we're all affected by these pretty linear transactions that take place as one thing eats another thing eats another thing. But how that then inflects on the community, right? How the diversity of the community is affected by what happens to its neighbor, right? And then realizing that this is how systems, all systems, function, interact, and relate to one another and adapt to the different contexts, the different fluidity of resource availability and need and history and the efforts of all the different actors in there, human, animal, otherwise, and the philosophies and other kind of crazy stuff that gets threaded throughout it all is a part of it too. But for me, that's a way of coming back to regenerative agriculture as an instance where the more we know and understand about these universal principles of nature, the more we can lightly interact with and positively influence the outcomes, increase the net returns for the desired outcomes that we want, and yield a better world, better lives, and better society. So, that's all I think. Thanks, Fred.
Thank you, Sheldon.
Yes, Sheldon, thank you. It was wonderful, 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 of course, to have you as a part of the BEHAVE program, to have you working with us. So, so meaningful, so touching at the heart level for me, all the years we spent together, working together.
No, for sure, right? And for those that don't know me or don't know that relationship, I got both my degrees with Fred as my major professor at the university started out in ag thinking I wanted to know everything there was to know about the ag side, but quickly realized that you had to understand the ecology and range natural resource side, but also the human side and the economics that goes with it and stuff. And after a decade and a half of working directly with Fred, one door down, day in, day out, forever, and naming my son after him. So, little Freddy.
Great tribute. Great tribute. Well, Fred, we probably...
No, what can you say? You know, it's the most meaningful thing to me, relationships with people. And that's what... In the end, to me, that is what's been most meaningful and important. And people like James and Sheldon and on and on and on. Just that's what made the whole thing worthwhile. Absolutely. And then the creativity that flowed out of that project flowed because of those relationships that we had with one another.
Yeah.
So thanks, you guys.
Yeah, thanks James and Sheldon for paying tribute to Fred and kind of sharing real world examples of how the influence and the ripple effect of one person living their life, living their mission, doing it boldly and humbly. So Fred, anything you'd like to say in conclusion here before we wrap up?
I just say thank you so much, Jared, to have the opportunity to spend time with the group. I'm happy to share any papers or information that people might want. I think if we ever want to get together again, and I would love to hear what all of the people that are on this program are thinking and doing. I didn't get to hear from many folks, but in the same sense that James was saying, I find it always so valuable to hear what other people are thinking and doing in relation to the kinds of things that we were talking about today. And I'm happy to correspond with folks as well. But just thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with you folks. It's a blessing.
Well, the blessing is ours, Fred. We sincerely appreciate you taking time. What's the best way to correspond or communicate with you? Is there, or to learn more about your work, Fred, where would you recommend people find out more?
You know, that Kathy and Beth put together a website called Behave. And I think that site's still up, although Beth is retired. I think there's some there. I wrote a book after I retired, just trying to, you know, we published a lot of papers, probably 250, 300 by now, but I was just trying to pull everything together in that book and kind of give the highlights of some of what we're talking about. That book's called Nourishment. So that's a way to, and there's an audiobook adaptation that's an update on it that came out a year ago. And if people don't want, the book's, you know, I tried to take a lot of detail out of it, but the book still, as I understand, is fairly dense reading. You know, there's a lot of information in the book. And so if a person wants something that's maybe not quite so, gets the big picture, but not quite so information dense, that audiobook adaptation is a good way to get into more of this. Then I'm happy to correspond by email. I'm happy to share if people have interest in certain things that we touched on that they'd say, you know, well, how did you do such and such with sagebrush? We've written accounts of that, or how, you know, different things that we touched on tonight. I'm happy to share any of that with folks. I think.
Perfect. What's the best email address for you, Fred?
I think fred.provenza@usu.edu. And you can be free to share that with folks, too, in case they didn't get that. But I'm happy to correspond with people and try to be a conduit to get information But everything I touched on, there's a lot that's been published, a lot that's being published, if people are into that sort of thing that they want. I also was asked, I reviewed a paper for a Holistic Veterinary Medical Association a year ago, and they asked if I'd write a prospective paper, which I did. And then they said, look, will you break this into three papers? That's just coming out too. That's an update on a lot, overview of a lot of the things we touched on briefly today, and updates along all those fronts too on stuff. I'm happy to share those. One's been published. The other two are ready to be published.
Okay. All right. I think I've got it here in the chat. For those of you who want to copy that, and Fred.Provenzit, usu.edu for those that are using audio recording. And well, wonderful. It's been an honor to be here with you, Fred. So as we wrap up, just a reminder, well, let's see, we won't be doing one in 2 weeks because I think that's Thanksgiving. That's probably not the best time to hold a webinar. So catch us in December. We do have a 7-day regenerative challenge is what we're calling it. So we're meeting at 6:30 Pacific time on Zoom. If you guys are on here, all of you should have gotten an invite to that in your email boxes. And so just look for that and I'll send it out again in the morning. And what that is just, we talk a lot about in Ag Steward about our stewardships. And this in particular is about building the steward. It's about building us, increasing our capacity and our efficacy to affect change upon our stewardships. And really, that's the one thing that, you know, stewardships, the land we manage, the cattle we manage, the cattle may live or die, the land may come and go. But as us as a steward, I believe that's what's eternal. And that's what we want to focus on in this challenge is building ourselves. So we're 2 days into it. Don't feel bad about jumping in midstream. You can certainly catch up. And they're quick, about 20-minute classes, just a quick instruction and then some accountability in the morning. So 6:30 Pacific time. But thanks everyone for jumping on here again. Thank you, Fred, for being gracious enough to join us. And we hope that we can see all of you again on a future webinar.
Thank you, Jared. And thanks to all of you as well. Take care.
Thanks for joining us on the Profitable Steward Podcast. Want to learn more about making your enterprise more profitable? Check out Ag Steward on our website, www.agsteward.fyi. Here at Ag Steward, we're working hard to make sure you have the latest tools and knowledge from the field of regenerative agriculture. Subscribe to our podcast to keep up with the latest info and help us spread the word by giving this video a thumbs up, sharing this information with other farmers, and as always, please join the conversation by leaving us a rating and a review so we can help you to keep growing strong.